I'm Brian McCreath from WCRV with Elizabeth Rowe, the principal flutist of the Boston Symphony, and Jessica Joe, the principal harpist. And the two of you are the soloists for the Mozart Flute and Harp Concerto. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with me about it today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us here.
So I wondered how much you got together beforehand. Is the Mozart a piece that you the two of you had to gather together and figure out what you're doing well ahead of time, or is it the kind of thing that sort of falls into place pretty quickly, Elizabeth?
Well, we met well over a month ago, I think, primarily to decide which cadenzas we were going to use, which was something that we wanted to do enough in advance so that we could assimilate them and feel comfortable with them. And then we met again for a pretty long rehearsal just a few days before we brought the piece to the orchestra to sort out some interpretational choices. Yeah.
So that really doesn't feel like a lot of time that you would spend together before diving right in.
I think this is one of the pieces for myself. I have done it numerous times with different flutists, but with Elizabeth, because I have worked with her numerous times with chamber music settings, chamber players. So I'm pretty comfortable, kind of timing-wise, just from playing in the orchestra. I think I know her timings, and we know each other's timings. So we didn't really need to go into too many rehearsals to decide. So it sort of plays by itself. But then we did decide on certain dynamics here and there, and just and of course the cadenzas.
Sure, yeah. Sure. That makes sense. So Elizabeth, there are other flute concertos that Mozart wrote, and I wonder how different or similar his writing is in this piece compared to those other concertos.
You know, it's interesting. I think this is my favorite of the three by a long shot.
Oh, wow.
It's so beautiful. It's really just absolutely a gem from start to finish. And, the writing is pretty similar between all three, but I think this one has some just extraordinarily beautiful moments and that just make it really exceptional, and I think in a little bit of a different category from the other two, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting because, I mean, you're not the only one in the spotlight.
Right. Well, that also makes it a lot of fun. I mean, it's really great to collaborate with Jessica and just to share the stage in that way. And I think that the writing is, I mean, it's quite beautiful for both instruments, I think.
It's definitely, this is the only Mozart for harp. So, and it's a masterpiece for harpists. So every harpist has to play this. But it's also a very low, it's difficult, but in a sense, when I'm on stage, I feel, I have somebody with me on stage, it takes some of the pressure away and it makes it a lot more fun.
Yeah. When you say it's a masterpiece for the harp, do you mean that Mozart wrote really well for the harp? Like he really knew what he was doing with the instrument?
This is actually one of the, it may sound very simple like any Mozart, but it's actually very difficult on the harp because in fact, I think this is written for not a modern day harp. So that's why I think that's majority the reason why it's in C major, because it's although it does modulate quite a bit, it does gets chromatic. But at the time, the harp probably it was written for a harp with two level of pedal changes. So which means it's not chromatically ranging wise. It cannot be too chromatic in that sense. Yeah.
Right.
So for harpist, I think anytime when harpists play scales on the harp, it's very difficult because, we play with our fingers and each of our fingers are different length. So if you have to play a certain degree, like a certain tempo, you have to make all the fingers sound very even as if they're all the one length. And I think that's the most difficult part of this this concerto. And of course, there's on top of that, you have arpeggio. So up to tempo, this is really, you can tell right away, from the very first arpeggio, the first harp solo. If it's sounding good or having a hard time because it just shows so much. Yeah.
Well, Jessica has phenomenal facility. So if she makes it sound really, you would never guess listening to her. I know from having played this piece also a number of times how difficult it is for the harp.
Yeah.
And she just knocks it off, no problem.
Yeah. But this is the kind of thing that would never occur to someone who actually hasn't sat down and tried to play harp, that the different lengths of your fingers causes actually kind of a difficulty.
Yes. So if you think about it, it's the simplest thing, like a scale on any instruments, but on the harp, because our length, and we only use four fingers, because our pinky is way too short. So therefore, it's when you play any scale that's longer than four notes, you have to make all these turns, and all the turnarounds has to sound very smooth, and that's what makes it difficult. Yeah.
Right. Elizabeth, how early did flute become sort of the center of what you wanted to do with your life?
Well, the story goes that when I was, according to my parents, when I was in kindergarten, I wanted to start to play the flute because I really was drawn. My parents played a lot of classical recordings in the house, and I always was drawn to that sound, which was the flute. And I told them I wanted to start the flute, and they said if I still wanted to start the flute when I was seven, then I could. And so I stuck it out, and I was determined.
Let's see how persistent you are.
I was persistent, and so I started at seven and had a little, few little bobbles and bumps along the way early on, but was pretty serious by, you know, late middle school and definitely in high school. So, you know, more or less since I've been seven.
Yeah. And Jessica, I know that your mom was a harpist, and and it was really early that you had a harp around the house that you could sort of play with, but she started you on piano.
She started me on the piano. In fact, I always find it interesting because all my friends, like Elizabeth, here, when I came to the States, that most of my colleagues who are born and raised in the America, they chose their instrument, like they wanted to play it. I think I just grew up in China. It's a different thing because my, you know, in China at the time, my parents, even today, my mom was saying that at the time they wanted kids to learn music because it was a really better way to make a living, actually. So at the time, you know, because my parents both worked in the orchestra, and then it was much more stable. It was a, you know, it wasn't rich income because nobody was rich at the time in China, but it's just very stable. So you knew you kind of, you can be in an orchestra and it's, you can make a pretty good living. So I don't remember being, you know, really wanting to play the piano. I never wanted to play the piano. So my mom said, you have to learn, keep an instrument. So I said, well, I was very drawn to the harp because she had the one at home and I thought it was more like a toy because you can pluck the strings with your fingers. I just always thought it was more fun than the piano. So that's how I took on the harp.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Do you remember that time when your family came to the United States? I mean, what do you remember about that time and your first arriving
here? Well, at the time, it was very hard to get the visa for Chinese to come into the U.S. So I actually couldn't come with my parents at the same time as they got their visa.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they came 3 years before. Well, my mom came first, and then my dad came a year after she did, and then I was able finally to get my visa like 3 years after she did. So there was 3 years I was only in China living with my grandmother. So,
oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. And so by the time you got here, your parents were fairly established and you had
a part of it, you know, smoother
ride.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. So Elizabeth, you've been in the orchestra. This is your 12th season,
right?
I think,
right? Mm-hmm.
Right. So I'm curious about what you feel like, if anything, has the BSO changed over the last 12 years?
Oh gosh, I think the BSO, I mean, has changed in a number of ways and also has stayed the same in some important ways too.
Okay.
So
yeah.
I think, I mean, there's been a lot of just personnel turnover within the orchestra since I've been here. So there's a lot of young players and a lot of really wonderful sort of personal energy within the orchestra, I think.
Yeah.
It's a very happy environment at the moment. And there's just a lot of positive energy, which is wonderful. There's also, thankfully, a really strong contingent of musicians who've been part of the tradition of the orchestra for a really long time, and they help us, all of us who come in younger and newer, sort of learn the tradition of the orchestra and the sound of the orchestra and understand the context of the way the orchestra plays. And so I feel like I just snuck in at a time when I was able to still work with some of these great maestros that we are losing now. It's a real, I feel like I really barely got that into that generation that had access to those that certain kind of musical mind that those great maestros had. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah.
But certainly a lot of the people who've been in the orchestra for much longer have an even deeper sense of all of that.
Yeah, no, it's one of the great things about a place with a tradition like this, that there are these things that are passed on to new generations. Jessica, when you came in, this is your seventh season now.
Yeah.
And do you feel like all of that, this passing along of an identity and connection to great musicians of the past, has that changed your playing very much?
I think it's bettered my playing because it makes you nothing but to match, you know, what the level is expected. And it's very, the environment of the orchestra you come in to work, it's just very enjoyable because you're always you're trying to, I think one thing that I learned really quickly is timing of the, how to fit in, you know, especially for harp, because I think even though it's not an instrument like flute, you know, anytime it's very so exposed, the solos, but when I do, it's a plucking instrument. So where I pluck, where I make that stride, it makes a huge difference. And I had to learn very quickly, you know, this orchestra has a tendency to play a little bit behind the beat. And it's something that, but, you know, eventually you just get the hang of the timing, and then you sort of, it doesn't matter who's on the podium, you sort of do it as a orchestra as a whole. And I think that's definitely part of an example of a tradition of a great orchestra. So, yeah.
I had to learn that too. That exact lesson.
This is interesting, though, because I think that if someone were to hear a player in the orchestra say, well, this orchestra plays behind the beat, that might sort of at first strike you as, well, that's a problem. But it's actually not. It's just a character. And so talk about that, Elizabeth. What does that do? What does that mean in terms of what an audience member hears?
Right. Well, it's a great question, because I think that someone might very easily say, well, why don't you just play on the beat? That would be so much simpler.
And, right.
But I think what comes from playing a little bit behind the beat is the quality of the attack, the quality of the start of the sound that we make is not so kind of sharp and clipped and hard the way that often happens when you're really trying to meet the beat precisely. So when what this does is it gives sort of a depth and richness to the start of the sound, which is really characteristic of this orchestra in general. And it just because of the physicality of playing an instrument, it's almost impossible to get that depth in the sound and have it be bingo right on the spot, right on the mark with the beat. Yeah. It's just kind of a natural thing that evolves with the orchestra. Also, there's a lot of chamber music style of communication within the orchestra too, and so when you're looking at somebody else, and Jessica's talking about the timing and learning how to play together, there's a visual component to that too. You see and you wait and you move together, you breathe together, you play together, and that just inevitably takes that little tiny bit of time for everybody to be on that wavelength together, and then we go.
I think this orchestra is one of the other characteristic is the way we blend. We blend really well to each other, and that's something. Again, you just have to open your ears. I have to learn really quickly, and what to listen for. And eventually, you do it at the same time as the others. In fact, I was talking to my mom, and she said she went to the rehearsal because she was in the orchestra where BSO played. Had an exchange program in 1979.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
She said that
she's in the orchestra.
No, she wasn't in the. She was in the national orchestra.
Yeah.
So
she was
had
in the exchange.
Yeah.
Did the exchange. That's
right.
Amazing.
So she said they did the opening of Beethoven Fifth with had to be Seiji. So she said it was amazing because they saw the beat come down, but there was no sound. But then when the orchestra played, the first one, it was so together they were amazed. But she said it was not at all.
What they're
used to. Like she said, they don't know how the orchestra played together, but it was just so amazingly together, but yet it was not with it. That's what they remember. It was not with the conductor. So, you know, that's even back then, I think it's something very special.
Yeah, no, I think it is one of the defining characteristics of the orchestra. And in a certain way, it's organic because it comes from lots of people over lots of time.
Right.
But it's also on another level, it's actually a decision.
Yes.
Because there are other orchestras that almost do the opposite.
Right. But
their
whole
goal is to be right on top of the beat.
Yep.
Right?
Right. Yeah. And I think that's just, you can hear that in the different qualities. And it's not necessarily that one is maybe better than the other, although I think we would probably strongly prefer the sound that we get. But I think that it's just a different aesthetic. And so there are certainly orchestras that pride themselves on a kind of precision and clarity of ensemble.
It's different style.
It's just different. And a lot of that is also a product of the hall that we play in, too.
Absolutely,
It's just this hall kind of asks for that richness and warmth.
Yeah. So it's hard to talk with any players in the BSO right now without asking you, just tell me about Andres. What's he like to work with?
And I think we're so lucky to have him. And I think that's why people seem it's a happy environment, because everybody, he makes people, I think one word to describe him is he's very genuine.
Yeah.
And he's young and he's not pretentious and he, you know, there are times he's young, he's very relatable, and you can talk to him.
Yeah.
So
right.
I think it makes the music making very mutual. So it makes everybody wants to, you know, play our best. And it's very exciting. So
yeah.
And because he's young, so I feel the performances, You know, in the beginning, I had a little hard time because I feel the in the rehearsals, and then what he does, he gets so emotional. You know, sometimes he does different things in performance, but I think that's what makes it exciting, and that's something, it's a learning process, you know, on both ends.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
He also, I've heard him speak very eloquently about the place of classical music in our culture and the value of it, and he's a really remarkable advocate, I think, for music in our general society, in the schools, in our, you know, basically anywhere that we can extend ourselves into the community. And I think that that's something that is an unexpected and really wonderful quality that he brings to his role. Sure. With the orchestra is a real ambassador out to the community in a way that I heard him do an interview on the radio, and yeah. He was so absolutely sincere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And very compelling. And I'm a musician. I know why we're supposed to, my music is important. So I don't need to be convinced, but I just was quite, I found it very compelling.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was really appreciative of that.
No, I think he definitely, you know, when he speaks, you can tell he's a sincere person, and it shows in the music making. He's, you know, very genuine.
Yeah. That's great. That's great. Well, Elizabeth Rowe, Jessica Jo, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with me today.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.